Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show...
Death and Hope.
Death and Hope, indeed. Yeah. An update. We talked to Jody Ellis, you know, usually a couple times a year, it seems, or definitely once a year, about the emerald ash borer. She's an entomologist at Purdue University. One of her charges there is to follow the progression of the emerald ash borer. And there is some good news coming out of Purdue. They're finding that there's some pesticides that are working if you take... preemptive measure in controlling the emerald ash borer. And the bad news is that it's here. So
unfortunately,
all of that information will indeed be pertinent to us across Kentuckiana. So yeah, stick around if you've got a big old ash tree in your backyard, because you'll want to hear what Jody has
to
say.
Or some small ones.
Yeah,
you can save yourself.
Yeah. And Dr. Patrick Angel, who is sort of an angel of sorts.
Yeah, he is.
I think it's safe to say, but really pushing some innovative ideas on reclamation lands after coal mining.
Fascinating story, because I sort of assumed and thought that most of the reclamation out there was just grasses. You know, you go out there and it looks like South Dakota forever.
And we've talked to folks about how they've done the grassland thing, and then they've reintroduced the elk and different sorts of wildlife to sort of complement.
But they're going one step. They're putting trees back in the mountains. Go figure.
Yeah.
It's a five-step process. Very interesting. And he's very hopeful. And he spent his entire life in the mountains, grew up in eastern Kentucky. And he thinks there's hope here. It's going to work, that they can actually reforest some of these devastated mine areas by using proper techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing it.
They're doing it, yep. So we'll be talking to Dr. Angel in the second part of the show, so we hope that you'll stick around. I know that mountaintop removal issues and reclamation issues are a pretty hot topic. So
there's
you know,
no silver lining up to now.
There's not really.
Until I heard Dr. Angel talk.
Yeah, no kidding. So, yeah, very interesting stuff. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Another mini rant, actually, this time. I'm in my rant mode, I guess. But I want to ask people not to buy any trees or perennials with the tags that don't carry the hardiness zones, hot or cold. That drives me nuts. You go into some stores, especially box stores, and they'll sell you...
That's why you shouldn't shop in box stores.
No, there's a lot of good trees and plants in there. That's not totally true. I know you say that all the time, and I don't feel that way. But
I do.
If they don't have on the tag what zone it's hardy in, don't buy it. Pick it up, take it to the manager, and say, how hardy is this tree?
And they
it's
won't
not
know.
Hardy here. Well, I know that, but if enough people do that, maybe we'll stop selling it or put the... hardiness zones on the tags.
Mm-hmm.
It just drives me crazy, and that's wrong, because most of the time they're not hardy here. And they're trying to sell stuff that maybe belongs in Florida or Georgia or Alabama in the Louisville area. So that's Bob's rant for
the
day.
That's your rant. And I'm not very uplifting. I've got some uplifting news.
Right.
How about a chicken update?
Okay.
A chick update, I should say. They are getting very big, and they are getting ready to go out to the coop.
How are they doing egg-wise?
Well, they're babies still.
I know.
They won't produce until, you know, a while.
Okay.
But it is really amazing how quickly they've grown. And, you know, now that they're fully feathered, they're probably about this big. How big is that?
That's about 12 feet tall. Yeah. What a chicken. She stood up on her toes, folks.
No.
12-foot chickens.
10, 12 inches-ish tall.
Yeah, that is. Yeah.
Fully feathered, so they're ready to go. You know, and the weather's fine now anyway.
Yeah.
But what we've done, Bob, we built... Actually, it worked out pretty well. We had some kind of crate side pieces, so we just cut chicken wire to size over those, you know, staple gunned it on, and then we've created a nice little neat section off inside the coop, so when they go out there, they get to go in there, and the big girls can't pick on them. So they have, you know, before, you want to make sure they kind of meet each other and nobody, so also their little box area in there, that means they have access to the hatch door. So we can open that door up. They get to go outside in the chicken yard.
Okay.
And be outside.
Oh.
And then my girls, the big girls, I'll just open the door, you know, the regular people door.
Out they go.
And then they can go out into the barn and then outside. So everybody stays separate until we know everybody's going to get along.
So when this chicken detente happens, how are you going to pull that off? I want to be there with
you.
Mean
like when they actually get
yeah,
to
yeah the
be,
detente when the big
when
the
there's
chickens.
No screen in between.
Yeah, just the chicken on chicken.
I just will have to see what happens and be ready to throw my body in front of somebody who might be getting picked on.
Oh man,
I don't. I mean, honestly, Bob, it's like this whole sort of like bit, you just take one step in front of the other.
They've done it for
and
years.
Do it exactly because I was so nervous about just raising them to begin with. And it hasn't been much trouble at all.
You're
you
right.
Know? You know, so you can't freak yourself out.
And there's no college to pay for either.
Exactly. Only eggs to wait for.
Well, not quite the same.
But it's been delightful, I have to say. So
I can tell.
Wish me luck when the detente does indeed happen.
We'll bring
you know.
In the United Nations and negotiate the entire thing.
I'll let you know.
All right.
There's things going on around town. Actually, this sounds super cool, Bob. You know how Udell's a part of the Garden Conservancy?
Yep.
Let's see, the Garden Conservancy has this open days program. They have it across the country, right? Mm-hmm. So Louisville's going to have an open days, and basically means that anybody can go, no reservations, nothing. Anybody can go to these five gardens across the Louisville area for the open days. So if you want to check out these fabulous gardens, go to our website, which will link you to the Garden Conservancies, and you can find out which gardens are a part of it.
Are they private gardens?
They're all private gardens
oh.
that you would otherwise not get to go to unless you were invited over to their house for dinner.
Well, yeah.
And you just, it's the date, May 16th, Bob. The gardens are open. It's $5 to get into each garden, which supports the Garden Conservancy. So just go at your leisure if you want to.
I'll go. I'll be at Bernheim that day, I think, but I'll go maybe that afternoon.
You will be at Bernheim that day because that's the other event that's on that day,
okay.
Which is the Bloom Fest. They yep. have the Color Fest in the fall, and now Bernheim has Bloom Fest yep. in the spring. So that's also May 16th.
Yep. And if you want to get warmed up, May 14th is the annual White Halls Peony Festival. They have 50 different kinds of peonies there.
Mm-hmm.
From 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., you can walk the grounds. You can buy some really exotic, interesting peonies and just enjoy the place. Whitehall's another institution here off Lexington Road.
Absolutely.
That's, they have peonies from all over the country. Expert gardeners will answer your questions. So more information on the May 14th Whitehall Peony Festival. Again, go to our website at
absolutely.
WFPL.org.
Mm-hmm. And then we got an email from the Community Farm Alliance folks, too. And they are opening or trying to initiate a new farmer's market in the eastern part of the downtown area
yeah,
of Louisville.
Yeah.
And basically it's a call out. If there's anybody that's interested in being a part of the farmer's market, they're looking for new vendors to join the Gray Street Farmer's Market. It's going to be open from 11 to 3 every Thursday. So a different day, but that will appeal to, you know, folks going home after work. So, yeah, check out our website for more information on that, and we can hook you up with the Community Farm Alliance people.
And one correction from Bob. In last week's show, I think I said that the Appalachian Spring dogwood is red. It's white.
It's white.
The wrong word jumped out of my mouth.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Nobody's called or sued yet, but I hate to be wrong, especially on the air.
I know. Well, so. We've got one planted in the in our, as Andy calls it, the sun and shade walk. So
we'll see.
We'll see for sure.
Maybe it'll be
right?
the only red one available.
It may be. All right, on to the grimmer things, the reality of pest infestations
in Kentucky. The death part of the show.
Our death part of the show. But fear not, part two will have the life part and the uplifting part.
Oh.
But Jody Ellis is joining us now. Jody Ellis is the exotic insects education coordinator in the Department of Entomology at Purdue University, where they've been following the movement of the emerald ash borer for a long time. And it has been detected as far south as Floyd County, Indiana, likely in Kentucky as well. So things are getting, you know, increasingly tense, but I think there's some good news as well because they're finding out that there may be some treatments to stop the emerald ash borer's destruction.
And homeowners can do it.
And homeowners can do it, indeed. Jody, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us as always.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Great. Listen, just to give us and our listeners a general background on the emerald ash borer, if they haven't yet heard of it yet, can you describe what it is, the damage that it does?
I'd be happy to. The emerald ash borer is an insect, and it is an insect that doesn't belong in North America. It comes from Asia. An interesting kind of insect in that it's very specialized, and this particular one happens to be specialized on North American ash trees.
Mm-hmm.
Well, ash trees, but over here it's North American ash trees, and they do tremendous damage to them. Part of the reason for that is that North American ash trees do not have any resistance to the insects, so once they attack your tree, unless you do something with pesticides, it will die.
Mm-hmm. How long has it been in the country, and kind of give us a progress on its march up to further conversation on the subject.
Well, it's estimated that emerald ash borer came over in some type of wooden packing material to the Detroit, Windsor, Canada area in the early 1990s. And the problem was that it wasn't found or identified anyway in the U.S. until 2002. Mm-hmm. So it had lots of time to spread, and spread it has, or I should say we have spread it. It didn't spread on its own, but it's spread from Michigan to Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Maryland. I think I'm losing some in here. Virginia, Missouri, Wisconsin.
It's been identified in more states than the last time we talked to you then, huh?
Absolutely. Okay. I'm sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, as you said, we have contributed to the spread of the emerald ash borer as well. So, you know, moving firewood, moving nursery trees, you know, do they jump on your car? I mean, you know, how are we expediting the spread?
Well, the spread of emerald ash borer is largely done when it's in its larval stage or its immature stage. And that's what makes it so insidious, because it's a white grub when it's immature, and it lives underneath the bark of infested ash trees. So you're not going to see it. You're not going to really know it's there. People have a sick tree in their backyard, a sick ash tree, and they say, well, you know, ash is great firewood. I'm going to take this down, and I'm going to share it with Aunt Millie over two counties over, and they've infested Aunt Millie's area too, and they don't even know it.
Right.
And this is what's gone on for over a decade now, and we've moved it far and wide. On its own, it only moves about half a mile a year, so it'd still be in Detroit if we hadn't moved it.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll have a picture of this on our website also. Describe what they look like so listeners will know.
Well, when they're adults, they're actually kind of pretty. They belong to a family called jewel beetles, and the reason they're called that is because they're a metallic green, kind of emerald color. That's where it got its name. They're only about, the adults are only about half an inch long, and they're kind of narrow, and they have relatively big eyes. If you run across one, that would be kind of rare, because they generally hang around up in the top of the trees. Now, the larvae are white worm-like things that live underneath the bark of an ash tree. I am not advocating you go out and pull the bark off your tree. That would kill your tree if nothing else did. But if you happen to have some bark falling off and you saw this worm-like thing underneath that was making these curvy S-shaped feeding tunnels and underneath their ash tree's bark, that's pretty diagnostic.
Mm-hmm. So there's no way to really know if you have an infestation until the damage is done?
Well, there are a couple of things you can do, and one of them is to look for woodpecker damage on your tree, and of course in the winter that's easier to do. Fortunately for us, ash trees bud out kind of late in the season, so you can still get out there and take a look and see if you see these, it's called flecking, where the woodpeckers kind of chip off pieces of the bark to get to the insect underneath.
Sure.
You see a lot of that stuff on your ash tree, something's in there that they're looking for, and many times it is emerald ash borer. But also look, as the season progresses, look at the top of your tree for dieback in the top parts of the branches. That's a sign that, that something is not right with the vascular tissue of your ash tree. That's what that tissue is that they're under the bark feeding on.
All right.
Jody, catch us up, because the last time we checked, they were in Floyd County, which is like 3 minutes from here in Louisville. Any in Kentucky yet, or how is the spread coming this direction?
Well, I'm going to stick myself out on a limb, if you'll pardon the pun, but I'm going to tell you that my best guess, it's already in Kentucky. I'd be very surprised if it wasn't. That is not official, though. I mean, I'm not telling you that, that it's in Louisville, but I would not be at all surprised if it was there. Once again, the problem is detection is not always easy of emerald ash borer. We do have USDA, APHIS, and a lot of the states have a trapping program where they go out and put these purple panel traps. They look like big purple box kites. And you'll see them kind of at the top of the tree, and those are designed to lure the adults to let us know that emerald ash borer is in the area, and that's indeed how we found it in Floyd County.
And they stick to these traps, right? So it's like a sticky purple trap.
Right. For some reason, and I don't know why, but emerald ash borer adults are attracted to the color purple.
Mm-hmm. So that's how you can monitor more or less of an infestation in a certain area?
They do this throughout the whole country.
Okay.
And there's a bunch of them down in southern Indiana. Kentucky has a trapping program in effect now, too.
I've seen them around our house, actually. Uh-huh.
Right, and you will notice those up. And I urge people, if you see them, do not interfere with them. A lot of times kids do think they're kites.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. And they're sticky, and you don't want to mess with it.
Right.
Yeah, I was encouraged to read in a Purdue University news release, however, that there's hope. Pesticides can protect valuable trees from the emerald ash borer. So tell us how the homeowner can do that.
Yes, and that is the good news. You can protect individual trees, and what I mean by that is if you have a lovely ash tree in your yard that you just simply can't part with because it's maybe the only tree in your yard or it's very important to your landscape.
It shades my back porch, in fact.
Well, you can protect that.
I'm going home after the show.
Well, you might need that.
Yeah, I know.
Especially since
you know how much it would cost to take that tree down and how long it would take to replace it.
I know.
You may want to instead protect it with pesticides, and it's best to do that before emerald ash borer attacks it. So you're in an area where I would start thinking about doing that.
How do I do it?
Well, there's a couple ways you can go, and it depends on the size of your tree. If you're go out with a tape measure and pretend you're measuring your tree's waist, just like they measure you for a pair of pants, at about chest height. If your tree is under 43 inches in circumference, then you can treat that tree yourself, providing the tree's in good shape.
I'm there.
Okay, well, if that's the case, you can go to any lawn and garden store, and you want to buy something called a soil drench. And what you're looking for is a product that has 1.5% of a certain chemical, and that chemical's name is imidacloprid.
Okay.
And there's many formulations of it. Bayer makes one that's very good, but there are others out there, too. You take that home, you mix it in a bucket of water according to package directions, and you pour it around the base of your tree. You want to do that now. You don't want to wait any longer than now. Your tree will uptake that, spread it through the tissues, and if an emerald ash borer larva happens to bite into that, well, it'll die.
All right.
Is there any chance of this chemical, because people always ask, hurting pets or dogs or cats or anything like that?
No, because this chemical is taken up by the tree. It's not It's not
don't
outward.
Pour it on your pet, but like since it's kind of soaked, since it's a watering sort of treatment, it soaks into the soil, then it takes the chemical into the tree.
Oh,
yeah.
Now,
cats.
if your pet is an emerald ash borer larva, I can't.
Yes.
I was afraid you'd ask me that.
If your tree's larger than 43 inches, it might be time to call in the bigger guns, which are the tree care professionals who have special equipment and special formulations of different chemicals. One of them is imidacloprid. There is one that is very promising called emamectin benzoate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one company that makes it. It goes by the name Triage. Yes, and it is wonderfully effective. The best news about it is that you have to do everything else once a year. Triage you can do once every 2 years, but it can only be applied by professionals.
Okay.
And then it's injected.
I was going to ask you that. The death of the tree, will it be over several years? Will you have a chance, or once it starts, is it all over?
These things kill quickly, and they kill trees within 1 to 3 years, usually. So by the time you notice it, you've probably had it for at least a year.
Mm-hmm.
So the best thing by far is prevention. If you're in a very, very, very early stage of infestation, you can probably rescue your tree. But don't count on that. Better to prevent than cure.
All right. Absolutely. So two methods in terms of preemptive action, depending on the size of the tree, 43 inches under, you can take care of it yourself. 43 inches over, you might need to hire a professional.
Right, and I'm going to warn people, too, if your tree is in terrible shape and the branches are already dying, it's been hit by lightning or whatever, it's probably not a good candidate for the pesticide treatment.
Okay. So just generally speaking, Jody, homeowners, I mean, I know that we've gone through it in more detail, but just sort of tick off the most important things for them to be aware of if they do have the ash trees, you know, in their landscape, and they want to be diligent and watchful.
Well, first of all, check your newspaper. mm-hmm. and see if emerald ash borer is anywhere near. And in your area, that is a true thing now.
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
Sorry to tell you that,
yes,
but it is true.
This is why we have you on.
Yeah. Go out. You know, a lot of people have ash trees and don't even know it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go to websites, learn what an ash tree is, and if you have one, go out and look at it and check it periodically for symptoms such as dieback in the top of the tree, or the tree doesn't look well to you, mm-hmm. or it looks unhealthy, or mm-hmm. If you see little tiny D-shaped exit holes around the crotch where the branches and the trunk join,
mm-hmm.
that's not good.
Okay.
So that D-shape. And once again, in this time of year when you can see the bark on the tree way up, even pull out some binoculars if you need to and look and see if there's that flecking stuff going on with woodpeckers. Mm-hmm. Any of those things are cause for alarm.
And in fact, I know that, you know, really in the last decade or so, the ash tree was sort of a darling of street plantings and parking lots because it is such a fabulous tree and a tough tree. But now we're finding that this is going to make it even more vulnerable if they're overplanted.
Oh, yeah. And they've been overplanted like crazy mm-hmm. all through the Midwest. There's neighborhoods here where I live up in West Lafayette where 60 to 70% of the trees are ash.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine what happens when this insect comes through and takes out, you know, what that's going to cost, not only financially, but aesthetically, what that's going to look like. And as you guys know, the biggest lesson here is plant diversity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Never plant just one type of tree. It may look nice, but if you have something like this come along, and I'm afraid this is going to happen more and more,
you got nothing left.
Yeah, you're mm-hmm. not going to have anything, or you're going to be out a lot of money.
Okay, I got a tree. It's killed by the emerald ash borer. I got to cut it down. What do I do with the wood?
That is a good question, and once again, it depends on where you live. If you are in a quarantined area, as over 20 counties in Indiana are quarantined, it is illegal for you to take that wood out of the quarantine area.
Mm-hmm.
You can let it lay. You can let it just rot back into the forest. You can use it on your own property as firewood. You can have a person with a chipper come out and chip it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Death to the larvae.
Right. If the chipper is certified by the Indiana DNR as making chips less than 1 by 1 inch in two dimensions,
mm-hmm.
it's no longer quarantine material because larvae won't live in it.
Huh.
But even if you don't live in a quarantined area, I would urge you to go ahead and treat your ash wood as if it is quarantined.
Right, to be on the safe side.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's not just homeowners who are going to be affected by this. Our forests mm-hmm. are going to be ultimately paying the price for this. And the further south we go, the more ash there is. And I don't want to think about losing 6 or 10 or 20% of our forest component.
Mm-hmm. Awful.
Especially since we've already been through it with, what, elms and chestnuts mm-hmm. and potentially oaks and
right.
all
and
kinds
remember,
of stuff.
We can't go into a forest and apply these pesticide
right.
treatments that work so well in a backyard.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't do it on that scale.
Yeah, so people pay attention.
Yeah, please do.
All right, Jody, thank you. We appreciate your time as always.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Uh-huh. Jody Ellis is an exotic insects education coordinator in the Department of Entomology at Purdue University. She's a part of a team monitoring the spread of the emerald ash borer in the state of Indiana. For more information on the purple panel traps, the emerald ash borer, and treatments, please go to our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up after the break, Eastern Kentucky native and Department of Interior soil scientist Dr. Patrick Angel talks about reclaiming the mountaintops with trees. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
Talking more about trees.
Some, you know, it's borderline on the fence, like depressing, but also encouraging.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You can't quite figure out if it's good news or bad news all around.
Yeah, you know, we have the emerald ash borer taking them down. We have a guy out in eastern Kentucky putting them back up.
We get
new ones, yeah.
Yeah.
And land that really needs reclaiming more than anything, the coal mine fields and so forth. And
mm-hmm.
interesting guy. He's an eastern Kentucky native and UK graduate named Dr. Patrick Angel, who spent almost 30 years with the U.S. Office of Surface Mining, inspecting mine sites and developing a way to reclaim the land. He's with us today to talk about the Forestry Reclamation Approach, or FRA, which provides for planting trees to help recreate forest land on areas decimated by coal removal. Dr. Angel, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you.
Well, before we begin on the topic at hand, let's talk about you a little bit. You grew up in eastern Kentucky. You went to UK. So talk about your background in the mountains and maybe what led you into this area you're working on now.
Well, I'm a native of eastern Kentucky, and, you know, my family lived in and around coal. My relatives mined coal, and, of course, you know, were impacted by coal surface mining. And mm-hmm. So as a young lad in the eastern Kentucky, you know, I was influenced to do something productive about, you know, the problems associated with surface mining.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, how'd you direct yourself then that way, just into, you know, soil science, that sort of thing, geology? I mean, what was the direction back then that could, in fact, help what was happening back home?
I went off and studied forestry. That was the first thing that I wanted to do, to understand the process of reestablishing forests on surface mines. You know, I came back to eastern Kentucky after doing that and went to work immediately as a surface mine inspector for the state, for the old Division of Reclamation back in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, you know, a problem that was very common was landslides. Landslides mm-hmm. coming down off of surface mines that were literally going in the back door of occupied homes and dwellings while the occupants were running out of the front door.
Wow, yeah.
And so stability was a very serious issue back in the 60s and the 70s. You know, there was a lot of landslides, mass instability, and rocks rolling off the hill and so forth. So, you know, as an inspector working for the state, that was, you know, one of the things that we kind of focused on.
Well, yeah, Patrick, can you give us a sense of the size, how many acres are involved in this process, and also is it mountaintop removal, is it strip mining, is it underground revival, is it everything?
Actually, no one knows how many acres have been disturbed by surface mining and deep mining. It's, you know, not very many records have been kept in that regards. We know where those mine sites are, but total acreages is very difficult to pin down.
But it's thousands of acres, surely.
Hundreds millions
of thousands,
of acres.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Millions
of acres of disturbed land throughout Appalachia, you know, from Pennsylvania and Ohio all the way down to Tennessee and Alabama.
Yeah. Sure.
I want to say I saw somewhere that it was like, at least just in the Appalachian Mountains, like almost 800,000 acres that were barren.
Well, Virginia Tech did a study recently that made a pretty good educated guess at the number of acres that that exist out there that are essentially barren grass wastelands that they could that have the potential for being reforested.
Mm-hmm.
And that number is somewhere around 741,000 acres. So 750,000 acres can be mitigated, reforested, and put back to healthy, productive forests.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that, the Forestry Reclamation Approach, or the FRA. Give us some history on that, and then we'll talk about how it works.
Okay, well, you know, I have to go back to the comments that I made a little bit earlier in regards to the landslides that were occurring back in the 70s. You know, as a young inspector, I knew, and my colleagues knew, that a federal law was going to be passed very soon, and that was we were waiting for that and hoping for that. And finally, in 1977, President Jimmy Carter in the 95th Congress passed this law called the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977, Public Law 9587. It's commonly referred to as SMCRA, S-M-C-R-A. And when that law was passed, we had great hope that the landslides would stop. I was hired as one of the first inspectors to go into eastern Kentucky. In fact, my badge number was originally number two.
Wow. Wow.
Number one quit after about a year. I had enough of it.
Wow.
But and I have the distinction of having issued the first federal closure order under SMCRA, you know, the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, for a landslide up in Harlan County, Kentucky. Now, I remember telling the operator when I closed that mine operation, that, okay, we're going to stop these landslides. In fact, what I want you to do is to grade this mine site so tight and so compacted and so rigid that there will not be any landslides ever again. And, of course, we solved the problem on that job and, of course, on, you know, other jobs, surface mine operations across the mountains. But in doing that, we kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater in regards to forest productivity.
Solve the landslide, but then you create even a more hostile environment for reclaiming it, huh?
And the reason for that is because of soil compaction. We required, myself included, mine operators to start compacting and creating this golf course look. And, of course, Mother Nature doesn't like a golf course at all in regards to biodiversity. You know, just a handful of species actually, you know, grow on a golf course. And so we kind of, like I said, threw the baby out with the bathwater and created these environments that are very, very difficult, were very, very difficult to get reforested. Now, as we progressed through the years, you know, the scientists, like at the University of Kentucky and Virginia Tech and West Virginia University and so forth, kept telling us, hey, you guys, you regulators are really creating a problem here. There's these, the forests are not coming back. You're creating barren grass wastelands in the beautiful mixed mesophytic forest of Appalachia. And, you know, this is Kentucky and West Virginia and Virginia. It's not Nebraska or Colorado or Wyoming.
Right.
And so, you know, at the hands of the regulators and the industry, you know, there's significant forest fragmentation caused throughout Appalachia. Now, around the 1990s, mid-90s, the scientists really started putting the pressure on the regulators.
And when you say the scientists, does that include the folks from University of Kentucky, Virginia Tech, West Virginia, or just all over?
All over. There was a great number of researchers looking into this problem. And, you know, one thing that they observed is that on pre-law mine sites, in other words, old abandoned mine lands or, you know, these legacy mines back that date back to the 1950s and 60s.
That were not super compacted.
That were not super compacted, just real loose and so forth. They grew trees like crazy. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, you know, in the coal fields of southern Illinois, the researchers found the highest forest productivity in the entire state on old pre-law surface mines.
So Mother Nature led the way.
Mother Nature led the way. You know, in western Kentucky, Peabody Coal is currently harvesting merchantable timber from surface mines, planted red oak and white oak and yellow poplar and other high-value hardwood species, you know, that were planted in the 60s and 70s. So the researchers looked at this old, these old mine sites and said, okay, well, what's going on here? Why can't we do this on post-law mine sites, on modern-day mine sites? And so they came up with a five-step, straightforward methodology called the forestry reclamation approach. And that's what we're trying to promote across the coal fields today to restore forests on mine sites where forests once stood.
Has it been used anyplace?
Yes, it has.
Okay.
In fact, it's being used all across the eight states of Appalachia, from Ohio and Pennsylvania down to Alabama.
Okay, walk us through the five steps then. How do you do this?
Very, very quickly, the five steps are, number one, create a suitable growth medium. You know, select a growth medium that is the very best, whether that's topsoil or whether it's, you know, brown weathered sandstone or whatever, the very best available material should be salvaged and stockpiled and then redistributed across the surface of the mine site so that you have at least 4 feet of the very best material to grow trees in.
So, Patrick, does that mean that before you start a project, you sort of have to, like, take the good stuff, move it to the side, extract your coal, and then bring the good stuff back?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Basically, you know, just kind of segregate it and make sure that the acid-bearing material, you know, the real pyritic material, is buried deep in the coal pit, and then, you know, the topsoil, the brown weathered sandstone, or whatever's the best available, placed on the surface. Now, that's step number one. Step number two is pretty simple. Don't compact it. You know, just simply loosely grade the topsoil or the topsoil materials or the growth medium. That's, you know, so that you have a non-compacted growth soil growth medium for the trees. The third step is use native and non-competitive ground covers, you know, a herbaceous cover that's compatible for growing trees. We want to get away from, you know, using Cerisa lespidiza and Kentucky 31 fescue, you know, those real competitive grasses and legumes. There's a lot of really good grasses and legumes that are tree compatible. Mm-hmm. That's what we want mine operators to use. The fourth step is to plant two types of trees, early succession species for wildlife and soil stability, and then commercially valuable crop trees.
And what do you mean by early succession? That,
well,
they,
you know, like dogwood,
turnover,
red buds,
uh-huh,
and hawthorns,
okay,
and, you know, trees that grow fast. They're kind of like what they call volunteer or pioneer species.
And provide habitat and food and such.
Right.
Okay.
And they, those will serve kind of like as nurse trees,
okay,
for the higher value hardwoods that are, you know, will eventually become, you know, the dominant species on a particular site.
All right, I understand, yeah.
And then the last step is to use proper tree planting techniques, you know, planting the trees properly, making sure that there's no J-rooting, making sure that the tree roots don't dry out, that the, you know, little seedlings are placed in the ground properly, so soil air is not a problem. And so each of those five steps are very important. They're of equal weight and really need to be employed religiously.
Now, who is responsible for doing this, the coal mines or the government or some combination? Is there law behind this?
Yeah, the law, the federal law, requires all surface miners to reclaim their mine sites.
And well, can they use trees if they want to, or grass if they want to?
They
still?
Actually, you know, the law is pretty liberal in that regard, right, and it's kind of caused some issues.
Right.
Mine operators and the landowners decide which post-mining land use they employ.
So aren't they all going to decide to go the cheapest way then?
And sometimes that's done. Yeah, you could say that, I guess. But actually, what the scientists are saying, what the reforestation experts and forest economists are saying, is that this is the cheapest way for the mining industry to go, to create a forest instead of a, you know, barren grass wasteland. And if you just think about how it's done, you can understand what I mean. Instead of requiring grading to where mine sites are finely sculptured and, you know, like look like golf courses,
okay,
and so forth, which may require, let's say, 10-15 passes with a bulldozer.
You just
all we're asking for is just one or two passes with a bulldozer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, intuitively you'd think, well, that must be cheaper for mine operators, right, in terms of equipment time, man hours, diesel fuel, and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there lumber at the end of the process? They can recycle the trees at some point, too?
Absolutely, yeah. These are, so, you know, what we're recommending are high-value hardwood native North American trees, things like white oak and yellow poplar and red oak, ash and sugar maple and black cherry, you know, things that are valuable crop trees.
Now, how many acres could you guess have been done, and are the numbers growing exponentially?
Well, yeah, since we started in 2003, you know, we are seeing an increase in forest land, forestry, post-mining land use. And so each year we've seen, you know, an increase in the numbers. And just recently we made a pledge, 7 billion tree campaign, to plant 38 million trees in 3 years.
Now, has Kentucky been a strong player in this program, or just the other states?
No, Kentucky has been a very strong player in this initiative. In fact, the state of Kentucky kind of led the way back in 1997, when they issued the very first policy memorandum to encourage the planting of trees on mine sites as part of the reclamation process. And from that initial policy memorandum, the other states followed an example, and actually the federal government followed Kentucky's example. So, yes, absolutely, Kentucky is out front on this.
So, Patrick, is there a chance, you had said that the Surface Mining Reclamation Act from the 70s, kind of loose in terms of what you have to use with the reclamation process, is there a chance, do you think, as this program picks up, that there will be federal legislation that could potentially kind of mandate that type of reclamation?
Well, we don't expect that. The law in and of itself is fine. The law itself was not at fault.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was in the implementation of the law. In the early days of SMACRA, you know, we focused on the stability of landforms created by mining at the expense of restoring forest land capability. So the law doesn't need to be opened up and tampered with.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it says, thou shalt not compact.
Where would one go in Kentucky to see examples of this, of the success of this program?
There are many examples out there. A number of coal companies are leading the way. For example, Appalachian Fuels is doing a lot of reforestation. Pine Branch Coal Company in Perry County is out front taking the lead. ICG is a strong player in the reforestation process of mine sites. They're all taking the lead sort of from the research plots that the University of Kentucky established at a mine site called Starfire.
And how old is that one?
In Perry County, Kentucky. Now, that's about a 10-year-old mine site. And, oh, my goodness, you must go there. The trees are huge.
Huh.
The crowns of the trees planted on Starfire under the FRA, under the Forestry Reclamation Approach, closed their canopy in just 7 years.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah, normally that's, 18, 20 years.
What a reversal of what we've come to know as coal mining reclamation and the results of it. Patrick, at that site, for example, is there sort of a spontaneous return of wildlife there? Or does there have to be some sort of active reintroduction of certain, wildlife species?
No, actually, there's a huge wildlife component to this. You know, when you restore the forest, you restore the wildlife capability.
And they just go back on their own?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Patrick, you don't sound like a shill for anybody. And it's been such pessimistic news from the mountains about slurry pits falling in yards and mountaintop removal. And you actually, this is a sign of progress. How hopeful are you that this can work?
I'm very hopeful. I'm devoting my career to this, as well as hundreds of other foresters and reforestation experts and soil scientists and so forth. We really believe that this is, it's not the panacea for, the issue of surface mining and the problems, environmental problems that are related to that, but it certainly is the very best way to reclaim surface mine.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, sir. It's been encouraging to talk to you.
It certainly has. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Eastern Kentucky native Dr. Patrick Angel is one of the leaders in the fight to restore trees to the Appalachian coal fields. For more information on the program or Dr. Angel, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Janine Wishy.
You look like a girl with some questions.
I do indeed have some questions.
Right.
Not me personally.
Do you come here often?
We've got a couple questions we can address, Bob. How's that? This one's
okay.
From Barbara Cook. She says that she had a river birch cut down and was wondering if it's better to have the stump and roots ground out or whether there's some other alternative or approach. She says because of a tilt, I've got some of those trees too.
Yeah.
Because of a tilt, the roots are more visible on one side of the trunk than the other. So what do you think?
Well, to me, it always depends. I mean, I've got a chainsaw, and I could take it down to the ground. If I'm going to plant something else within 3 feet of it, that's fine. If it's somewhere you're going to plant something again in the same hole, you should take the roots out.
Mm-hmm. And it's all sort of up to the person, right?
Totally.
Like, can you bear to look at it for a while? Does it bug you? You know, there's not a disadvantage really to either other than time. And in terms of where you want to plant, you never really want to plant anything exactly back in that hole. If it's just, sawdusty, you'll have to bring in some topsoil or, good soil to amend it. But
a chainsaw in 30 seconds will solve the problem.
Put it all the way to the ground. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But there are, Bob, when I was in Buttons the other day, I noticed it. I can't remember what it was called, though, but there's like a product that you can purchase that's like stump rot facilitator.
In under 20 years, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly. Like you put this chemical on it and it expedites the whole decaying process. You can also put nitrogen fertilizer and it will expedite the decaying process as well. So, you know, fast, have it ground out,
whatever
not so
you want.
Fast, you know, let it rot. Yeah, it's not going to damage anything either way. Okay, here's another question from Sarita. She has a question about plum trees.
All right.
She's wondering which ones will do well here. As a kid, her husband said that in the UP, his family had a plum tree that thrived for 60 days of the summer and the 10 months of winter, but they're not really sure exactly what kind of plum tree it was, and she was wondering if there was something that would do well for us here.
I don't know of any. The Upper Peninsula of Michigan is a different ballgame than Louisville, Kentucky, and here they bloom so early that late frost, I think, gets the fruit almost every year. So I've never seen a plum tree here that I could eat off of.
I've seen some, but they're like in little micro environments. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Where like it stays a little warmer, they're more protected.
Yeah.
And they're delicious too. But it is a tricky sort of thing. My best recommendation when it comes to any sort of like wondering what kind of variety is the best, go to the University of Kentucky's Department of Horticulture, their website, and they have all these great packets of information, if you will, about fruit varieties for Kentucky. And in their plum section, you know, there's not that many really because they don't do that great here, but they'll at least recommend the varieties. And there's some that are self-pollinating. There's some that you need to cross-pollinate. But that's where you're going to find the best information in terms of what will do the best for us here.
Absolutely.
So that's that.
If you have a plum good question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246.
Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us today?
I have a story within a story.
All right.
I also like...
There's always a story within every story.
I know it. And I also like to bring up the names of people long forgotten because that's just not right. The story within the story, Janet and I both like the old-fashioned white flowers, the candy tuft, and the bridal wreath spireas, you know, the really gorgeous white flowers. And we lost that big tree out front. And I got a 160-year-old house, so we planted two of these big old bridal wreath spireas on each side of the walk there. Mm-hmm. We're kind of restarting over again with sunlight instead of shade and the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And this particular spirea is called a double Reeves spirea. Mm-hmm. So I got to wondering, why?
Who's Reeves?
Exactly. Turns out he's a Brit named John Reeves, born in 1774 and appointed inspector of tea for the East India Tea Company in 1808, sent to China in 1812, where he lived for 19 years. This was long before the Western world was allowed into China. He stayed there for 19 years, a very good naturalist, contacts back in England, made friends, traveled the area collecting specimens. But he also, more importantly almost, commissioned talented Chinese artists to paint detailed drawings of hundreds of animals, plants, insects, reptiles, and shells, many never even seen before in the Western world.
Wow.
Isn't that a great story?
Yeah, it is.
This guy's disappeared. He collected jade and marble artifacts, some now worth millions of dollars. And he shipped back from China, had named for him a very rare pheasant with 8-foot tail feathers and a dwarf deer that became instantly invasive across half of England. But he also sent back a lot of cultivars, the plants we now use fairly regularly, peonies, roses, camellias, curia, asters, yes, Wisteria sinensis, and a certain lovely spirea called Reeves Double that's now made its way to Utica, Indiana.
That's great.
That's a cool story.
It is a cool story.
Comes with a poem.
Good.
Why is it then that history will sneeze at all the work done by Mr. John Reeves, who spent 19 years inspecting China tea and collecting plants for you and me? One sure reason for the lack of hysteria may be the problems we have growing wisteria. Or maybe our world has enough to fear without adding another invasive deer. And yet there were those asters, curia, and roses, toward which it smells good to turn up our noses. He was a generous man with many a friend, so we can't allow his journey to end. So get out in your yard, get down on your knees, and plant one more spirea for old Johnny Reeves.
All right. Very good. Very good.
Yeah, he's back.
He is back, and at least he's back in Utica, if nowhere else,
he'd
right?
He'd be proud of us.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to check out the 2009 Old Farmer's Almanac and tree peonies.
Homegrown is produced by the ever-poetic Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishey. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.